You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 174A by Rudolf Steiner, 12 lectures, entitled Europe Between East and West in Cosmic and Human History, translated by Christiana Bryan. This is Lecture 11, given on the 2nd of May, 1918, in Munich. Today, on the first day of our branch reflections, and as befits conditions of the time, we will set out to consider what light can be thrown by the intentions and efforts of our spiritual science on all that confronts and interrogates people at present, filling each person with the challenge to fulfill at least such tasks as the spirit of the times most urgently sets them. It is upon each individual recognizing their task that the destiny of humanity may potentially depend. Starting with something that may be close to us, you will have noticed that for some time now there has been a change in the attitude of the world at large toward our anthroposophically oriented spiritual science, a change of mood that amounts to it being viewed in some places with greater antipathy. Only someone unfamiliar with the history of spiritual movements and who doesn't accord them due respect can be surprised at such a change of attitude and mood having set in. This will occur more intensely in future. As long as a movement such as this contains within its core aims any sectarian modalities, as long as, in this town or that, a few people get together in their front or back rooms to hold sect-like meetings, any striving movement will be regarded with a certain benign indulgence, but with an attitude that can easily turn into something quite different. Things may continue for the moment, while people do not consider us worth serious investigation, because movements such as these usually vanish again, and those front or back rooms revert to more domestic use. Attitudes of this kind have been prevalent for many years in relation to our movement, and what there was of antipathy only arose in isolated cases. Things have improved slightly, because in some quarters at least, there have been increased efforts to slough off any sectarian elements. Yet, particularly from among the ranks of our society itself, there has been repeated opposition to ridding ourselves of every vestige of sectarianism, opposition to uniting with contemporary culture. Strenuous efforts have to be made to challenge such opposition, to challenge such obstinacy, and to align ourselves with the aims of present culture. We will not be able to continue reading lectures in cozy comfort and so forth, though that can, of course, be a pleasantly familiar undertaking, as it will be essential to engage with what people long for in their various locations, so that precisely through mutual exchange with potentially differing or opposing movements in the world at large, we find out what is presently needed, and also what is found in anthroposophically oriented spiritual science. It will be our friend's most important task to unfold the requisite mobility of spirit entailed in taking leave of comfortable, safe, warm familiarity. It is essential, but its inevitability is not yet being felt everywhere. This leads directly to us asking ourselves, how will anyone in future, based on what originates in our spiritual movement, be able to get to grips with old inherited or new issues, even if they be armed with the belief that ours is indeed something new? How will what issues from us converse in mutual exchange with other movements? How will this interchange take shape? Well, above all, and despite apparent agreement arising sporadically, opposition will become particularly virulent from the quarter of official representatives of religious denominational world outlooks. Of these representatives of religious or confessional views, among whose ranks exemplary people who agree with our movement will certainly be found, the majority will nevertheless always insist on what they can read up in terms of their own inherited assets. Though populations profess not to believe in authority, they acquiesce to every authority, and with what religious representatives claim will find widespread resonance among the population. It will become especially difficult to introduce spiritual scientific content to one particular attitude, and this attitude rests in the exceptionally convenient manner to which human souls have become accustomed, on finding its relationship with spiritual worlds. How many people are there at present who say, "Oh, here comes one of those spiritual researchers who construct an entire stratified world of hierarchies"? First, one has to go up through hierarchies of angeloi, archangeloi, and so on to the highest divinity. People find all this too intellectual to accompany, and they point to what they call the only simple, naive relationship through which the soul can attain to God or Christ or such like, through strong inner experience. That is what one hears again and again from those of better intention: direct experience of the highest divinity. Why would a person need so and so many strata of hierarchical intermediaries in order to attain spiritual knowledge, when they can, with childlike simplicity, have an experience of union with the loftiest divinity? We do, however, need to ask ourselves, what takes place in the souls of those who, with a real, if comfortable, degree of honesty, describe their striving as being one of experiencing the divine? There are indeed people who have experienced a certain landslide or sea change in their life of soul, such that everything they call divine or spiritual now appears differently to them from the way in which it appeared previously. Some call this evangelization, others use different terms, but that is neither here nor there. It is their belief that they have found by naive, childlike means access to the highest divinity. People imagine quite simply that they have experienced Christ inwardly. What are they really experiencing? Now, my starting point is the assumption that the experiences in question here are honest and genuine, and that people really have experienced a change in their soul lives. I am also proceeding from a completely honest conviction and a certain judgment-free open-mindedness as regards inherited denominational directions of faith. What these people experience is at most the closest experience a person can have with what is spiritual. And what is this closest spiritual that is experienced? The closest spiritual experience is of a being from the hierarchy of the angeloi, a being assigned to each human being for their guidance, a being one can call whatever one will, Christ, the highest Godhead. It matters not what we call this. It matters only what it really is, to which the soul draws near when experiencing this honestly, when it is a real experience. It is an angel, an angelos. And we see this being only as the highest God. We are too comfortable to stride onward to something else, and the first closest being one encounters, one calls God. And one constructs for oneself, yes, what does one actually construct? The most egotistical religion it is possible to construct. The fact that all people are in agreement in uniformly naming their encounter is not the crucial factor. Because as long as people only want to experience what has been indicated, each one only experiences their angel. Each one prays exclusively to their angel. And though legions of preachers may speak of the one and only God, of the seemingly monotheistic God, in truth they are only speaking of millions of angels to whom people pray and whom they give the same name, thus herding people into the confused idea that these millions of angel beings are all one being. That is the reality. It points to the illusion to which one submits if one wants to unite with the egotistical God. There is even an external indicator of what I've just described. Try to take refuge in the learned resources used in cases when something exceptional is experienced. Turn to the most enlightened of those helpful aids and try to find out the origin of a most useful, most used word. You will find just one word, of which all scholars within German-speaking regions will say, the origin of this word cannot be fathomed. That is the word God, and its adjective, divine. Look in any German dictionary, and the word spirit is also described very unsatisfactorily, but still slightly better than the word God. You only get as far as knowing that the word God is of unknown origin. There are all manner of hypotheses, but it remains unknown. Is one still going to be shocked in face of such a learned result and the assertion that so many people speak of God and the divine and have no idea what they are talking about? Of course, because they are using a word of unknown origin to describe, well, whatever they happen to wish to describe. The matter is more serious than they want to admit. But people don't want their usages to die out and don't know how strongly they live by phrases, nor how happy they feel to be able to live in those phrases. That is one thing. But others can also be found. If one tackles what is real in what people experience today when they, even transcending their denominations, speak of their God, the God they experience inwardly, whether they name it mystically or theosophically, one finds in countless instances that people say, everything depends only on experiencing God within, on becoming one with God. With what is one actually becoming one? If one investigates what it is with which people become one, albeit without realizing it, it is nothing but their own soul, as it was before it entered physical existence prenatally, or rather before conception. How this soul lived between its last death and its present birth. Today people pray, even if they want to be upstandingly religious, either to their angel or to their own I, capital, as it was before their birth or conception. They call it God, designating it with a word of unknown origin. Yet what they feel looming upward from their unconscious is actually their own self. And the curious aspect that comes to light for anyone who can see through to reality is that from every pulpit there is endless talk of predestination. But since this is unthinkable without repeated earthly lives, this is, in fact, talk of earthly life, that is, of one's own self, which goes through this life, while denying the fact of repeated earthly lives. In truth, there is talk of nothing other than what anthroposophy wants to bring to conscious human knowledge. Now, people find it necessary to give this a name of unknown origin. They are actually talking about something that looms upward out of their unconscious and can be experienced mystically. They call it the union of man with God. In reality, it is the union of man with themselves, with their own self, as it was before their birth. In calling it God, people are being challenged to worship themselves. What is celebrated as religion nowadays is largely idolatry, idolatrous worship of the self. It is important to address this today, because it represents the entire seriousness of reality. Yet it is simultaneously uncomfortable, because it points to the enormous, deep-running deception pervading our lives. What led to this deceitful lie about life is something to which I have often referred, that in the year 869, at the General Ecumenical Council of Constantinople, the spirit was abolished. I also mentioned that those philosophically judgment-free people basing themselves on prejudice-free science today speak of human beings consisting of body and soul. In truth, the human being consists of body, soul, and spirit. But talk of spirit was proscribed in the year 869. And nothing at all was as proscribed by Christian philosophers of medieval times as talk of the so-called trichotomy, which included the spirit. No sooner had this trichotomy been abandoned, out of which, for example, Dionysius the Areopagite proceeded in writings that were copied as late as the 6th century, and which still speak of the higher hierarchies, as soon as leave was taken of what is still disputed today, of the ancient Gnosis, which has to confront us today, but which was in its time something immensely lofty, no sooner does one take leave of all this and take intellectual comfort into account, one is also gradually pre-condemned to speaking of something that led to a terrible deception in life. Because spiritual science has to speak the truth in these matters, it is no wonder that the most vehement opposition is aroused. Nowadays there is a large-scale lack of commitment to what human beings wish to bring to expression in their inner lives, and it is really the case that most people have totally forgotten how to listen with their souls. Often crass manifestations of this surface. It no longer matters to people what is actually being said. Everything depends on what they themselves have to say, quite regardless of its appropriateness. This is no isolated phenomenon. It is typical, and it occurs at every turn. I could mention not hundreds, but thousands of examples. It occurs in literature and across the board worldwide. Things of this kind, spiritual conceptions in present times, are closely connected with impulsions driving the present, with what the present is carrying out, and what has ultimately led to this catastrophe. One has to return to this time and again. There are always people today who feel compelled to speak of loving their neighbors, of committing to others lovingly and with understanding. But in reality, this is not accurate. In reality, the underlying mood is that which Fritz Mautner expresses in the case of Bol, with whom you are acquainted, where he roundly upbraids someone who actually agrees with him. These are instances which express in typically characteristic form what we need to focus on clearly and sharply at present. Only when we have developed the will to forge ahead into such matters will we find the perspective necessary to make progress and to make sense of where karma places us within human evolution. Above all, we will need to recognize the following today. It will be absolutely vital to observe what has been evolving in a person's essential being between their last death and present birth. We will not be able to continue duping ourselves nor creating illusions through self-deification or self-worship by calling what we find within us God, which is in truth our own genuine I, capital. We will no longer be able to succumb to such self-deception, but will have to look to our legacy from spiritual worlds, which each individual brings with them through their birth into physical existence. Where is that, actually? Yes, my dear friends, we bring it all with us. We bring immense wisdom with us and inherit spiritual treasure for our birth into physical life. But where is this wisdom? By being born, we are all so wise that we cannot believe how wise we are. But where does this wisdom reside? On the one hand, it dwells enchanted, having united with our bodily nature and its disposition, and on the other, in our destiny. It longs to be released from this. The potential lies within the present cycle of human time to release this legacy by free human activity, to raise it upward through higher I knowledge, and release from enchantment what lies dormant in our destiny. We can gain some insight into this by making clear to ourselves that the present human being lives quite differently from the human being of bygone cultural epochs. I want to remind you of something previously mentioned. I said that in the first cultural epoch of post-Atlantean times, human beings existed quite differently from today's humanity. As regards their soul spiritual life, they participated in the processes taking place in their physical bodies. Just as we as children experienced the change of teeth as a special turning point, sexual maturity as a soul change, the human being of the first post-Atlantean age, experienced their physical maturing right into their 50s. There then followed a time in which this experience of evolving ended in humans' 40s, and later still ended in their 30s. We are now only conscious of our maturing into our 20s. It is only into our 20s that we experience what is maturing physically, corporeally, in our bodies. Thereafter, we are to some extent liberated. We can no longer experience the quality we did during our descending, incarnating years. We now have to experience it by allowing ourselves to be fired by what is spiritual. Spiritual science has to give the impulsion to release and to redeem whatever lies enthralled in our bodies and our destinies. Modern education is very far from reaching any such insight, let alone pressing ahead with it. We will have to forge insight into this, that the motivation has to be laid in early youth to learn how to grow old. People nowadays do not know how to grow old. At most they notice that their hair turns gray, or how often that their hair is receding, or other signs of aging. But this is not the essential feature that can be present. The expectation, the hopeful expectation, of each new year in the certainty that we can learn something new with each passing year that could not have been learned any earlier. Each year brings something new. Each year brings new revelations, if only we understand how to put them to use. The mood must surely dawn in human beings by which they reflect, I'm going to be 20. The 30 to 40-year-old has something I cannot yet access. I will have to wait until that something is revealed to me. Just think, in every detail, what this would mean. If education were to lay the foundations for awaiting, with hopeful anticipation, all that lies ahead in life. The very opposite mood is fostered nowadays. People want to be elected to parliaments and assemblies in the first flush of youth, because they believe they are optimal in every respect and are fully furnished personalities. What you now find is young whippersnappers, both male and female, who proclaim at every opportunity, "That's my view." Everyone has their own point of view nowadays, from earliest youth onward. People do not have any idea whatsoever about waiting and hopeful anticipation of something, that life contains mysteries, which are only unveiled in stages. It would be quite something if this came into education. Then one would have the will gradually to release and redeem what has been enchanted and lies enthralled in our bodies and our destinies. Anyway, we will have to view culture as it gradually unfolds in a quite particular light, if we want some clarity in these issues. You will have to ask yourselves, where does one find the right standpoint, the right perspective, to release and redeem what lies enchanted within us? Yes, indeed, you may want to frame the question slightly differently. Why should one want to redeem what is captivated under a spell within? Isn't it more comfortable to leave all that to our blood, nerves, and flesh? Then it could just stay there until one died, went over into the other world, where it could eke out its existence. Just leave destiny to the nerves and muscles in which it is captivated. Why does it need redeeming? One should, and one must, redeem it because the ways of the spirit are subject to their own specific laws. What has been bequeathed to us as a gift of legacy from spiritual realms wants to be redeemed, longs to be freed from captivity. And this begins with being brought to consciousness. What lies in body and destiny longs to migrate aloft into consciousness. Its rightful refuge is within our consciousness. It ought to live in our consciousness and not remain under enchantment in our nervous system, in our circulation, in our muscles, or our bones. For it does remain in nerves, muscles, bones, or amidst an indeterminate, undefined destiny, that is merely born, then this spiritual element is transformed into something quite different, into impoverished forces. It is predetermined to be taken up by consciousness and carried into life. If it remains out with consciousness, yet still united with the person, it is transformed into either luciferic or Ahrimanic forces, and is gradually given over to Lucifer or Ahriman. Luciferic forces have long been reckoned with in our Western cultural evolution, and it is now resigned, due to a particularly well-regarded spiritual stream, to dealing with Ahrimanic forces and to onward life with them. People are to be installed in life, to find their allotted place in life. That is the aim of their upbringing. Certain motivational impulses, certain sensations, certain feelings are nurtured. Which of these impulses, these feelings, are put to use? Look around you in the world. It is now on the decrease and will soon be of little meaning. But it has meant a great deal for centuries. Orders, badges of honor, titles, virtues. But what lies behind all this? Feelings and sensations that grant consent to strive for them, compulsions and desires that amplify luciferic tendencies among humanity. Just think how much luciferic striving existed, was cultivated in human nature, in order to put human beings, diverted via this luciferic tendency, into positions they were intended to occupy. That was the luciferic period. It is now on the ebb. It is hardly worth talking about anymore, because what happens in this respect is on the wane. Even if people didn't believe the extent to which this is happening, they will soon notice it. It is talk of a direction on the wane if one is talking about actual luciferic cultural influences. Yet, Ahrimanic forces are menacingly on the rise. An example of this would be, at the moment, people, how would one put it, go through the, in quotes, academic jungle in German and other cultures, vaingloriously introducing what promises so vastly much by way of advancing humankind in the future, intelligence testing, talent screening. Within academia, some very peculiar plants have recently sprung up. Every hue of psychologist and soul researcher conducting experimental psychologies, investigating human beings, probing psyches, who have lately also been pitching into young people, considering them fair game. Because people can no longer deal with old examinations and the social order of yesteryear, young people are next in line for intelligence testing, so that, in language already widespread in rarefied circles, quote, the right person for the right job, close quote, can be identified. Obviously, children will have to start being tested so as to identify the right sort of person. Concept, capability is tested, and all manner of tests are constructed. How quickly a child can guess this or that, whether it can work out the function of a baffling item. Intelligence and memory are tested. Intelligence, for example, by showing the child or young person two unconnected words, mirror and robber, and expecting them to meaningfully link them using some concept. One child saying that even a thief looking in a mirror is seeing himself will possibly be considered the least intelligent. Another will think, the one from whom the thief is stealing, or even being killed by, has a mirror, sees the thief coming from afar, and can save himself. That girl or boy might be thought the brighter one. Some magazines are running brain-teasing, hair-tearing ways of testing intelligence. They are being developed as a particularly successful means of statistical analysis, putting memory and brain power to the test. Those able to say most, be it about, say, thieves and mirrors, will earn two or more marks, rather like on the census, with the one collecting the most such marks, making the most connections, being designated the brainiest. These are the young women and men who will be given access to specialist colleges and will be supported by all manner of means. what is typical of these achievements so praised by humanity, and the boldest pedagogues set great store by astuteness testing, is that they become absolutely no closer to soul elements, but only test in people what is harmonically dependent on their bodies. Thus the only thing being tested is how strongly Aramon can ripen in a given young person. What is being introduced into human culture are Aramonic impulsions, yet today people simply succumb to these delusions and deceptions. The most important aspect of our spiritual science is that its seriousness be recognized. Certainly one can gather in small conventicles and, as I said, read cozy lectures among family-like friends. That does no harm, nor by extension does what may ensue from without. But as soon as spiritual science starts to become more widespread, so must our seriousness increase, a seriousness which can only consist in committing unconditionally to what needs to be taken up in the context of everything evolving around us. It is essential that we understand this as deeply as possible. Essential also that we nurture mobility of spirit, which will enable us to emerge from sectarianism into a worldly wise, cultured conception of what our spiritual scientific movement should exemplify. For diverse initiatives need to arise out of spiritual science. Healthy initiatives, in contrast to the widespread emergence of decadent and degenerate impulsions. Above all, freedom and self-reliance of spirit are essential for what longs to enter this spiritual scientific movement. Belief in authority does not in the least align with us. Only does acquiring free and independent discernment. For nothing said about spiritual science can be generalized nor universalized. Everything applies individually. Everything is concretely valid for each specific case. It is a certain indolence that prompts people to generalize, but this cannot happen once one enters spiritual realms. Today we really need to commit to knowledge that doesn't merely remain in abstract or mystical generalities, but which proceeds from a grasp of spirituality and penetrates into reality. Some may believe themselves to be great mystics, making their solitary way through the world undisturbed by world events, believing God to be experienced within. But that is thin spirituality, so thin that it fails to penetrate the reality existing in the world. Mystics of this kind are not called for by the present. Loners can claim mysticism because it lulls them into the comforting belief that their elevated souls are experiencing loftiness. But the present demands strong spirituality that acts incisively in immediate reality. It demands not only talk of higher hierarchies, but such probing awareness of the higher hierarchies that, proceeding from such recognition, insight into what surrounds us on earth can be won. Because the time is now beginning when order will no longer be found in human affairs, unless genuine insight into the essence of what is evolving here on earth is won, even if that proves uncomfortable. Read the lecture cycle I gave in Christiania, quite some time before the war, in order to prepare for today. It concerned the connection and structure of individual folk souls. There you will see that you can take seriously what the higher hierarchies recognize, and can apply it to the configuration of the earth. Knowledge of this kind is essential for the present time, because knowledge has to provide the practical foundation for what needs to be undertaken in future. You will have to recognize what needs to be done, not on the basis of rhetorical scribblings and chatter, such as today expounds on issues of European populations and ethnicity based on purported observation. But you will really have to delve trenchantly into the impulses active on earth that issue from spiritual worlds. Admittedly, people today think they have something to say in every circumstance, because they have experienced something. Do you really think someone living a simple life in a remote Provence village between 1789 and 1800 has anything very enlightening to say about the French Revolution? They experienced it. they are not required to comment extensively. Similarly, countless people go to America or to Italy and can, as they like to put it, give you chapter and verse on the country and its people. Yet, what they say doesn't need to be of enormous value when assessing what is needed there. This latter involves having the opportunity to delve into the substrata of existence. For this we need, as far as I'm concerned, neither to embrace nor to reject materialism, nor indeed embrace nor reject spiritualism. No, for the researcher into reality, for the spiritual researcher in our case, it must be a matter of indifference whether their starting point is materialism or spiritualism. We don't need to despise materialism in every situation. That is not the crux of the matter, because it is of no consequence whether you start from materialism or spiritualism, if we are just going from A to B. Whoever really observes matter to its bitter end will find in all that happens materially around us spirit. And whoever wants the support of the spiritual and continually cries, "Spirit, spirit, spirit," ought above all to find a way from an abstract concept of spirit to a concrete conception of what takes place materially. Because what takes place materially is a manifestation of spirit, though you have to develop the correct belief in what is spiritual. Those who do not have a life filled with anticipation, with the expectant hope that with each new year new mysteries may radiate into us through our growing older, they actually believe, however much they speak of God and Spirit, in neither God nor Spirit. For they believe at the ripe age of 25 to be totally discernment competent. The rest of their lives, as regards their souls, will then be of little use or value. The Godhead will then reveal nothing further. You have to forge ahead with spirit right into the material and grasp it. What is spiritual has to be so condensed that it can find materiality. If we conceive of the material phenomena generally existing in the external world only in terms of what is within us, we would need to say there is an abyss between the outer world and what occurs within us. Spiritual science alone is capable of bringing externality closer to us and bringing us closer to externality so that the two meet. We can do this for individual human beings, and we can do this for Earth evolution. Issues of this kind have to be grasped. Natural science, as I indicated yesterday, is the very least equipped to grasp that the head is to be understood as being in regression, while the externalities are overdeveloped. It is particularly important that we understand such concepts. How does one get hold of them? They can be grasped by going beyond conventional ideas, beyond abstraction, by creating an imaginative view of our own imagination. One cannot view one's own imagining without simultaneously hearing what goes on materially in our heads during the process of imagining. In habitually imagining, habitual consciousness, one doesn't notice what goes on in one's head. That can only be observed once one has ascended to imaginative thinking. Then one can participate in experiencing the material process. And do you know what goes on in our heads while we are developing normal consciousness? A process of hunger is taking place. Wakeful, imaginative life consists in our head being hungry. Those faux ascetics and mystics knew this instinctively, which is why they allowed their entire body to starve. It is not normal, however, for spiritual experiences to arise by starving the body. That is always wrong. The fasting ascetic, hoping for mystical entrancement, is exercising an unhealthy one-sidedness. The state of equilibrium in our bodies is normally disposed such that from morning to evening, from external awakening until falling asleep, our heads, not our entire bodies, are in a constant state of hunger. Our heads are chronically undernourished, something inherent in regression, in regressive development. Due to the undernourishment of our heads, we are in a state that makes way for imaginative spiritual life. Those who learn to know imaginative spiritual life through imagination are aware of what others only know in its baser manifestation as the rumbling of their stomachs. That, from morning till falling asleep at night, our heads suffer rumbling pangs of hunger. This shows what we could describe as the spiritual advancing on the material in our own lives. One-sided mysticism is a comforting immersion in our interiors, where little more is experienced than a slightly denser version of what we usually encounter. True spiritual development involves strengthening spiritual life as such that, when applied to our own experience, we come to know ourselves more accurately, far more accurately. We also come to know physical corporeality better, because this is brought closer to us, so that corporeality is raised toward spirituality, bridging the abyss that is otherwise always present between what is spiritual and what is physical. This is how the abyss between spirit and physical can be bridged, also in the life of peoples. We ought to look at European folk souls, at least at some of them. You know, from the lecture cycle about the folk souls, about the connection between leading beings of the higher hierarchies and peoples. They are beings from the hierarchy of archangels, the archangeloi. But how do they work? Initially expressed in abstraction, an archangel is the leader of one nation or another. In saying this, we are no further than talking about the human soul, which, between birth and death, can only exist here because it has a material base from which to evolve, namely our bodies. Likewise, an archangel who, in leading a people, is connected with external materiality. The connection between the purely spiritual being of an archangel and that of a people is a material one, even if this is not so distinctively outlined nor sharply contoured as our bodies. We ask, for example, how is this the case with the population of the Apennine Peninsula, those Romans of old, a once Germanic people who are now Italians? Basically, the majority of the population in that area are transformed Germanic peoples. Yet they owe their configuration, their folk determinacy, to something else. In their breathing process, in the air they breathe, their archangel is, as it were, quote, aired in, close quote. One cannot quite call this inhaling, incarnating. In breathing in and with air, the inhabitants of the Italian peninsula connect with their archangel. Whoever wants to study this in depth, so that they come to a real recognition of what is actually at work here, we'll have to make the idiosyncratic connection between the population of the Italian peninsula, the Iberian peninsula likewise, but to a lesser degree, with breathing and with air. They will have to find out how air and this particular breathing process are commingled within human inner life. It is different with the population presently inhabiting France. Here the archangel casts a different bridging connection, one which works through all that develops the human organism through liquid. French people widely drink in the folk character with their wines, and also with the other fluid elements that feature in their organism. You see, in this way you arrive not merely at an abstract depiction of the connection between the spiritual world and the physical. Here is an outline which similarly only hints at the archangel, while, down below, human beings go about their lives and are guided by their archangel. Spiritual science can elucidate processes such as these so that they can be grasped in all their concrete reality. The inhabitants of the British Isles receive what their archangel bestows with the solidity evolving in their bodies. They absorb it by forming solid components in their bodies that connect with their solid structure. Obviously only applicable in a restricted sense and here radically expressed, yet this is not just a mordant truth, but a spiritual scientific verity. The archangel affects the British through their eating of beefsteaks. This is obviously not meant in any chauvinistic sense, because every single individual is an exception in themselves. It is only applicable to one aspect of the human being. Yet inasmuch as each also belongs to their people, this principle is active in them. It will only be possible to learn about the world as a whole if future generations are not afraid to research such things further. People have an incurable fear of the truth, because from truth uncomfortable issues naturally ensue. Yet as soon as you take truth seriously, it is essential not to shrink back in horror in face of your discomfort. Let us turn to America. Purely from their external configuration, it is clear how dependent human beings are on what radiates from the ground. In Italy, it is from out of the air. In France, from water. In Britain, from what defines solidity entering the body or causing it to be solid. It is quite different in America. You will find in every quarter that spiritual science finds its confirmation in reality. It is just that this confirmation is not yet being sought. In a lecture, I once posited that the evolution of the consciousness soul, which particularly emphasizes the human ego or egotism, is externally, materially exaggerated by sugar. I indicated at the time how vastly greater sugar consumption is in the British Isles than, for example, among the selfless Russian people, where sugar consumption is far, far less. But when I describe how it is only around the 15th century that the consciousness soul is in the ascendant, one need only observe the increase in sugar production, which also begins in the 15th century. Where does sugar production actually originate? From the 15th century onward, people start to become dependent on sugar. Everything genuinely educed from spiritual worlds by spiritual science is fully substantiated, precisely when it evolves spiritually to such a strong degree that it is able to plunge into materiality, where it then exists and has to be recognized. As soon as one transits to America, one finds not just externally that Europeans who have emigrated evolve different arms and legs over the course of time. Their limbs then resemble more closely those of original First Nation Indian, in quotes, populations, who have been so depleted. This also applies to the configuration of facial forms, even though it may arise quietly in third and fourth generations. Obviously, we are not imagining that within the span of several generations, smug British worthies come to resemble original ethnicities, yet certain faint resemblances can sometimes be detected facially. Subtle phenomena of this kind need to be faced, because it is only through knowledge that genuine true love can develop across the world. Love can only be engendered by finding one's way toward other human beings. For this, one needs to grow to know them. Their folk spirit works upward into American folk from the substrata of the earth through magnetic and electrical forces slumbering in the earth. It is the subterranean that radiates upward, endowing America with the means whereby the folk spirit can guide people native there. Turning now to Central Europe, here it is a good idea to allow people to reflect for themselves. However, a few things can be mentioned. Actually, there are intensely limber, unstable, and highly personal elements connected with the material manifestation and ramifications of the folk spirit. These are primarily the effects of warmth upon warmth. The differentiation that arises between being warm externally and inner warmth, warmth in winter, the warmth of spring, of summer, in short, everything expressed through varying states of warmth. That is the medium through which the folk spirit works in Central Europe. Everything originating in differentiations of warmth on the blood circulation and breathing is the indirect route whereby the folk spirit is effective there. You can also follow this at a soul level. We still have the opportunity, unlike Fritz Mautner, to sense and elements of speech, the after effects of what I might call the warmed through quality of feeling. If one has not been abandoned by all the good spirits of speech, one is still able, in German, for instance, to feel one's way into language, not just abstractly, not just stopping short at the abstract stage, but by sensing the spirit of the language, because physical warmth is related to soul warmth. Nothing is more physically interrelated with the soul than soul warmth. Likewise, its opposite, cold. What lives in the sentient soul is more alien to air. What lives in the intellectual or mind soul is far more alien to the element of water. And indeed, what lives in the consciousness soul is alien to beefsteaks, or rather, to earth. And most terribly alien to the human soul is what comes to expression in magnetic or electrical forces radiating from the subterranean into human evolution in the American folk character. This is one reason why so much in an American's folk character looks as though it were obsessed with what it is doing, in contrast with a Central European who has to be present in soul, accompanying on a soul level everything they are doing, hence also able to generate mystical warmth. By contrast, Americans may easily evolve a psychic, spiritualistic frame of mind, may become possessed by elements that do not directly stream into human beings, such as air, water, earth, but primarily by subterranean forces working upward and forming the very structures of populations. In the Russian character, in what is being prepared in the East, the folk spirit works through light. Though it will only be called upon to play its unique role through its people in future. We will return to this the day after tomorrow. It works through light, though not directly through the light rained down from the sun, but through light first absorbed by vegetation and the earth itself, and then radiated back again. These sun forces, this sunlight rayed back from the ground, from earth and vegetation, is the medium used by the Russian folk spirit to effect and create folk structures and folk dispositions. If you observe this in all its detail, we shall return to it the day after tomorrow, you will see how the present and the near future do not require vague, nebulous mysticism full of empty phrases, but such a strongly spiritual recognition of spirit that it can plunge down, can penetrate the material existence with which we have to live. So that material existence in its relationship with the spirit is not viewed as something to be got rid of, not, as it were, purged from under one's skin in order to reach the spirit, as has been the mistaken case in the past, but that material be seen as a revelation of spirit. Those unable to see that what is physical is in truth a manifestation of the spirit do not yet have the right attitude toward the spirit. Everything surrounding us is a body of the spirit. Only if we are able to conceive of spirit such that we see nature as a body of the spirit, only then are we in a position to gain real spirit knowledge. This is concrete spiritual knowledge, and we need to aim for knowledge such as this. Aren't these precisely the issues, once one has approached them with the requisite deep seriousness, which modern people find so uncomfortable? Truths they do not love at all, and instead of which they would most prefer to hear, human beings across the world ought to love one another. Yes, definitely, but they must first grow to recognize each other. Love has to become independent of what approaches you in knowledge. And yet love can only become independent if it approaches us in knowledge. Everything I have described, including everything I characterized around the folk souls. You know this. Your nerves, your blood, your muscles know this. This is where it lies, enchanted, captivated, and it is from here that it needs salvaging. If it is not retrieved in the near future, it will rumble and fester in nerves, muscle, and blood, spreading throughout the world as disharmony, as compulsions to strife and war. Preventing this from coming about can only be achieved by the spirit, which is otherwise distorted into its luciferic or Ahrimanic counter-image, being released, redeemed from nerves, muscles, and blood, and brought to consciousness. Because it is only in consciousness that spirit longs to live here on earth. Only in consciousness is spirit in its rightful environs. Only there can spirit guide humanity toward what it must attain in future. Spirit cannot be allowed to remain abandoned in luciferic and Ahrimanic domains, because if it cannot find its rightful place, it distorts. Spirit's capacity to transform itself needs to be understood, because in recognizing this lie the tasks of the future. You cannot frivolously elevate yourself to the state demanded of humanity for the future. Instead, it is vital to delve deeply with knowledge to resolve the tasks of the future. For this, you need to overcome certain discomforts. And because humans do not want to overcome discomfort, they will increasingly become enemies of a spiritual evolution. You will have to reckon with this, especially once spiritual science becomes more widespread. You will have to reckon with it all the more the stronger anthroposophy becomes and the more you all take up the challenge of moving forward, away from comfortable sectarianism toward world citizen perspectives, working on a worldwide scale, spreading spiritual science abroad, out of those nice front and back parlors to all the places where you best believe you need to affect and deal with the concerns of humanity. That is what I wanted to speak about today. We'll continue the day after tomorrow. The end of Lecture 11.